Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. I am Fernando Arencibia, and with me, as always, is the ever-radiant Jennifer Wollman. Jennifer, say hi.
Hello, everybody. welcome, and thank you for joining.
Yeah. Jennifer, it's already been a busy year, and it's only we're only a little bit into it, but it always feels like this first month of the year is always full packed of outlooks, these, you know, introductory events into the year. Everybody is excited to get the year on their way. And today we're going to speak about one of our favorite events every year, and it's a great way to start the year, which is the CCIM Outlook Conference that is put together by the Miami District of the Florida chapter of CCIM. I think since I have really gotten into commercial real estate, I maybe miss one because I happen to be traveling, but I rarely miss it.
Right. And it's always one of the first conferences of the year with great speakers that really do a deep dive into what they saw in 2020, you know, the year before. So in this case, 2024's market and kind of what they're expecting in 2025, right, based on the year end. So it's always worth going to and absolutely seeing if you're, you know, what you're seeing in your own personal transactions and business marks pretty much what everybody else is seeing, and what some of the insights are in asset classes that maybe you don't transact in, because as you like to say, you know, real estate touches every aspect of our lives, and just because we work in one asset class that might be doing really well, we might be able to see pressure points that are happening elsewhere that maybe will eventually affect our asset class. So yeah, it was great. And Tracy Cohn, who's the new chapter president, did an amazing job, and great lineup of speakers.
Yeah. So yeah, to that point, I want to mention that I think last year's president in 2024, Robert Palacios, did an amazing job. It really feels that him and the entire board made an incredible effort to modernize the experience, the interface, the interaction between CCIM members and the Miami District, you know, within the Florida chapter of CCIM. And kudos to them. It's really great to see. And there were a lot of cool things that happened this year. And I'm looking forward to what Tracy and that entire team is going to do for Miami commercial real estate within the CCIM chapter here for this year and for years to come.
I agree. And to any of our listeners who are interested, you don't necessarily have to be a member of CCIM to attend a lot of their events, though obviously we highly encourage it. They also have monthly luncheons, and they've really been stepping up the luncheons as well. Places are great to network, and they've been having really, really good speakers at all of the lunching events. So you're bound to learn something and meet somebody that you don't know. So I highly encourage that. We'll put the link to the local CCIM chapter in our show notes so that you can take a look. But for example, this year they partnered for the first time with FIU, which is amazing. So many of our local schools and institutions have amazing real estate programs, and FIU, you know, so many people in the room were actually graduates of FIU, either undergrad or of their master's in real estate program. So it was wonderful to see that collaboration and the attendance. I mean, they broke record attendance this year. So again, kudos to the whole Miami chapter leadership team and the state as well, as always, our commercial real estate estate in Florida is kind of at the top of everybody's radar, and CCIM is doing a great job at not only educating but supporting their members and really bringing value and helping them increase their business and their bottom line. So let's get started.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I always enjoy about the CCIM outlook is that the structure has remained the same over the years. So we usually get a macroeconomic perspective that gets narrowed down to what is happening within the state and what is happening within the county. And that way you kind of get a sense of where the economy is and where we are vis-a-vis the rest of the country and what are the forces that are pulling and pushing on the key economic indicators that we always like to follow. And then we have presentations from experts in every asset class. So we get an update an update on industrial. We get an update of office, retail, multifamily, and development, right? Land. So it really is a great way to structure an outlook event for the year because usually the local experts also give you a sense of where they think the market is going into the year, what were the dragging indicators, what were the pushing indicators from the year before, and what are they seeing for the year to come. So it's always great. And this year we had a familiar face come back to do a presentation, which is renowned economist Casey Conway from Caseyonomics. And he always does a great job of kind of laying out where the market is.
And it was new this year because he brought his four-legged employee and economist, Charlie the dog, who was amazing. But definitely, it's always a highlight and refreshing to have Casey speak. And he started his presentation with a quote from Rudy Dornbusch, who, according to the New York Times, was a macroeconomist at MIT. And Rudy's explanation of why currency exchange rates sometimes fluctuate sharply became one of the tenets of international economics. But Rudy's quote was, economic cycles don't die, they're murdered. And I thought that was super interesting because he then went on to give us an overview of the U.S. economy, where he highlighted that the S&P set 57 record highs in 2024, which was the highest number of highs since the data has been tracked. But it was interesting that quote and why he wrote that. So I don't know, or why he started with that. So I don't know if you want to give a little bit of your takeaways.
No, it's always great because, you know, you're not in a room full of economists, right? We are practitioners. And so we have anecdotal evidence of some of the things that we're seeing in our marketplace. And sometimes when you get these presentations and you see what's at play in the economy wide, you begin to connect the dots as to, you know, what is happening. But it is true, you know, economic cycles die. And he presented basically a set of examples from 1974 all the way to 2020. It was really, really interesting how that entire thing plays a role, right? And so the conversation has been for the last few years about whether this economy is going to go into a soft landing or if it's going to pop, right? And we're going to have recession. So I think that is an ongoing conversation. I thought it was interesting that he mentioned to be watchful over the yield curve, the inversion of the yield curve, or the inversion of the yield curve in 2025. But one of the most important, and he called it the most meaningful economic metric to evaluate states. And this is something that Casey always does, is he does a comparative analysis of how the different states are performing. And he says that the most meaningful economic metric was the number of new business applications in the state. And I think that is an important component here. And he says that by all metrics, Florida is first in creating new businesses. And he says the applications from January to November of 2024 was almost 600,000 new businesses in the state of Florida. And then there's another metric that is they do it per capita. So it's basically the number of businesses per 10,000 residents. And that number, we're ranked top three there. So again, that was a really interesting dynamic. And he, what I really appreciate about KC, and this is something that I really have had a lot of conversations with people. I often ask people, how do you process data? What is it that you're looking at? What is it, you know, is there one or two things that you're always monitoring? And he's brought up things that in the past, like the U-Haul index, right? Where we get a sense of where people are moving to. And when we started looking at driver's licenses, data, and, you know, all those things that are interesting. And he says that this is a great metric to study. And I like it because, you know, we like the rules of threes. And sometimes you get bombarded with so much data that what do you gravitate to? What are the things that are going to be keystone metrics that are really going to make an impact?
Yeah, and the thing with jobs, as we've mentioned in previous episodes, and as Spencer Levy with Cushman Wakefield has said in the past, you know, those of us in the commercial real estate business really aren't in the real estate business. We're in the labor business, and jobs drive everything. And according to an April 2024 Florida Commerce press release, the small businesses in the state of Florida accounted for approximately 57% of the total private sector employment. And Casey pointed out that outside of Florida, the 2024 ADP jobs report showed that the sector that's hurting the most is actually the small businesses that a lot of other states are having issues. They're not seeing job growth. They're seeing small business contraction. So that's something to look for, you know, look out for and make sure moving forward that policies, whether on a local, state, or national level, do everything that they can to support the small business owner, because not only are they, you know, we always say that they're the fabric of our community. They're also one of the biggest job sources in any state.
Yeah.
So, and then to the U-Haul report that you mentioned, Florida's number four. So we've consistently been in the top 10 states for I don't know how many years of net immigration. So again, that goes to where you get your data from. If you're somebody who only listens to news and the headlines, sometimes you get a misconception of what's actually going on. But when you dive into these reports, and he uses a lot, the ADP jobs report, the U-Haul study, and then he says to also look at the earnings reports of companies like Procter & Gamble, because they show the average consumer and pressure points that might be affecting average consumer for, you know, in Procter & Gamble's case, for things like laundry detergent. Are they still buying the more expensive one? Are they going cheaper? What are the earnings of Procter & Gamble overall, which have a wide basket of, you know, pretty generic products that the average consumer would use? And that's a healthy indicator.
I like the concept of keeping it simple, right? And it's a very simple metric. You're looking at basically what they call do-it-yourself movers that are just basically getting a one-way trip in U-Haul from another state into Florida. So what a simple way to really, you know, monitor. And that's why I love this idea of a U-Haul index. You know, what a great way to monitor really that people are moving into one region or the other. And like you said, we have consistently been a part of it. And if we're in the labor and demographics business, then we have to look at, there are a lot of factors that go into being bullish on Florida and being bullish on South Florida specifically for many, many years to come. So I thought it was really good that he gave a sense of GDP growth. And he spoke about that it is not a bad thing that GDP growth slows down, right? And I thought that, you know, obviously there were two factors there that will consistently are always going to affect our market, which is interest rates and where interest rates land. But he does feel that GDP should decline back in the low to mid 2% range. GDP in Florida is a little better than that. I do like also the idea of following the ADP labor, which it's a metric that he enjoys better than what the numbers that the government puts out, because if anybody has ever heard Casey Conway, he's not a big fan of the way those numbers are put together and how they're edited. So they feel that he feels the ADP metric is a little more incumbent of what is really happening in the marketplace. Inflation continue to be a question that is in place. And this is where you were just mentioning that he says, look at the earnings report. So you could see how it affects, you know, and where the market is. And what he was saying is, we've seen inflation, but what companies are noticing, and he's extracting this data from the earnings report, is that the price elasticity has already reached is almost like its zenith, right? He's saying that he was explaining about Procter & Gamble. They're saying that they're higher earnings than expected. However, they fell short on sales despite price increases. And what they're basically saying is, this is it. We can't increase prices anymore.
Right.
Right. And so they've gotten to a place where they understand that, you know, they've reached that zenith. And so let's see how that affects where inflation hits and where pricing is and what companies like Procter & Gamble do with their product.
Well, and he also, you know, tying into that and showing that the consumer has reached their limit, he also spoke about the debt that the consumer has taken on, that credit card debt and home equity lines of credits are being tapped out, showing that the average consumer is feeling the inflationary pressures across the board. So he had that as a cautionary tale as well.
And again, like we've been discussing for the last 2 years, and I think it's going to be part of the topic for quite some time, especially when you're seeing what's happening around the country, around the world in regards to natural disasters and the like. And that is, you know, rising property insurance. And that is, you know, what he calls hidden inflation. It's worse than higher rates. That's something that definitely needs to be monitored. And I think that for the next 5 years around the country, we're going to have conversations about what to do about insurance, especially to handle these catastrophic events. Now, he also mentioned he gets a little bit into asset classes and he got a little bit into the outlook. And this is a thing that I think most people are going to, that should pick up out of these conversations. He says that industrial, multifamily, and data centers are going to occupy 2/3 of the interest of investors. So I thought that was really interesting. And I could totally see how that applies to South Florida. You know, and I know we also saw a presentation on industrial that was specific, but, you know, we definitely are underbuilt when it comes to industrial.
We're underbuilt in industrial, retail, and office, because we also attended another event the following evening, which was put on by Miami Commercial and Roderick Miller, the head of the Beacon Council here, which is kind of our local economic development arm here in Miami. He was saying the same thing that, you know, it sounds strange to say, but even office in our area has been underbuilt based on the demand. That was really interesting. And Casey did go back to your point, and he quoted the bottom line from Yardi for 2025. Office year-to-date sales price per square foot in Miami were the highest. We were at $369 a square foot. The only other state that came close was LA at $356.
Yeah, and that's a reduction from where LA was a few years back.
Right. And he also made an interesting comment. He said, look, there's a lot of pressure outside of Florida and Miami on office. There's still a lot more pressure to go. And he said, basically, if you can't buy it for $30 a square foot or less, just stay away because an opportunity is coming. And I thought that was, to me, that's not even land value here. Yeah. So
in regards to office, he presented this chart I had never seen before, and it's basically called the WFH research. And it's basically a measure of how many average days per week people want to work from home, right? And then they say what is desired, what is actual, and what employers plan for the years ahead. The worker desires, according to this study, right, according to this metric, about 3 days a week to be at home, to be working from home. The employer wants no more than about 2 days a week where they're working from home. And that's actually where we're at right now. We're closer to reality, where people are working in the office for about 3 days, and then there's 2 days where they're from home. So, and it's interesting because I was driving here. We're recording this on a Friday. The traffic yesterday and the day before was terrible in the morning. Today was like super clean. And it must be this thing where most people are working Tuesday through Thursday.
Right.
And then Mondays and Fridays, they're working from home.
Well, we're also getting ready to go into a long weekend. So a lot of people probably took off because they've got Monday off.
That's very true.
But the thing with that work from home that was interesting, and we've heard this before, and we might have even mentioned it on a previous podcast, is that due to financial regulations, anybody in the finance industry, such as banks, anybody dealing with cash finances are having much more scrutiny put on them by the government, where if you're in banking and you have somebody working from home, is their internet connection safe? All sorts, you know, what about their data? Everything else. So more and more of the financial industries, starting with like JP Morgan, who now said that they're going to have, you know, 100% return to work. And that's basically because it's going to be a nightmare for them to try to meet all of the regulations required if they have to go to every employee's house and set up those safeguards. And personally, from a consumer standpoint, I really like that idea. I don't want my financial sitting on somebody's kitchen counter or any information that they might have being in their, you know.
No, and combine that with what we heard from Rod Miller the following day, where I think it was our 2024 chair, Gus Fonte, asked, well, what industries are you getting the most attention that want to relocate to Miami? And he says that about 20-30% of that was the financial services industry, which is, you know, again, if you add that to this movement to make sure that the financial services employees are working from the office because of security concerns, then that again bodes well for the office sector in Miami. I also want to mention something that we heard about retail. I'm amazed with retail. I really am, in South Florida, because I remember not too long ago people saying that we had overbuilt retail and that we have too much retail and that it was, and man, the performance of the retail sector here. And now everybody's saying that we haven't spent 10 years without building. Right. And now we're underbuilt on retail.
Right. Well, the head of Woolbright said that Florida is so grossly underbuilt in retail for not only where we currently are, but where we're projected to be population-wise. So, and again, you get into the costs of land and everything else, and what needs to be built is just, you know, going to be that much more expensive when it is built.
I also thought it was a great anecdotal story that he mentioned. And, you know, here's another great thing about KC is that every story that he mentions, he always puts a link to the story. So he always references the source like a good economist should. He was telling about how when Barnes & Noble was getting restructured and they decided, you know what, we do want brick and mortars. Let's go back to the brick and mortars. And they had given up a lot of stores. And then when they tried to go back into the marketplace, there were no places available for them to open stores. And so it's incredible to see that. And apparently it's not only a Florida thing, right? It's a nationwide thing. Right. And the quote was like, you know, every time a store becomes available, there's intense competition because Burlington Factory took lots of Bed Bath & Beyond stores that it would have gladly taken them. But they were quicker, smarter, and richer. And there were a lot of people out there expanding fast and some very, very good retailers. And that's really a really interesting thing. And that has happened to me. Sometimes you have sent me, because you know the clients that we serve, and you send me a message. Hey, this company, I just read that they're closing a bunch of stores. And then I call and they're like, no, we've already have that. We already have people earmarked for it. It's really increasing the way and the speed within which these retail spaces are getting absorbed.
And that's where I want to go to the headlines, right? Yeah. So the headline that he used when he was talking about that was, you know, the big box apocalypse, right?
Right.
And several years ago, it was the retail apocalypse because nobody was going to shop anywhere other than online. And right now, it's the restaurant apocalypse. It's the office apocalypse. I'm going to tell you something, people. If you hear the word apocalypse, that's the time to buy, invest, or lease. And if you're a broker, those are where your opportunities are, because you're going to be able to lease space that's normally not available at a time when all of the headline news is screaming downfall. But the people in the office, in any asset class sector, knows that that's where the opportunity lies. And they're going to be presenting that to their clients. And that doesn't mean that they're going to get in for cheap, because remember, a lot of these big box stores had, you know, rents that were significantly lower. And a lot of the long-term leases don't have annual rent bumps, right? The rent bumps might be every 5 years, and they're minor, and well, they're less than you would get on a smaller space with a smaller company because you have a credit tenant. But when they do come on, they're at market, but the people who are coming in are also, you know, good tenant, good credit tenants, so they can usually get it for less than market or for longer terms, or they can get more favorable deals. You know, right now, office apocalypse, restaurant apocalypse, get in there now.
He did say to watch out as an opportunity for three different uses that are pressure. One of them is drugstores, branch banks, and Dollar Trees. You know, and so I was driving by a place and my wife was asking me about a restaurant that we really enjoy and that they're expanding. And she was asking me, where do you think they would be here in the Westchester area in Miami-Dade County? And I was driving by and I see this bank in the corner, and there's really not a lot of activity in the bank. It's actually a pretty nice size. It probably could fit two of those restaurants, but there's plenty of parking and it's on a hard corner. And I said, I don't know, it might go there. And she asked me, well, why? Are they selling? Are they closing the bank? They're not closing the bank. And I go, like, I just have a feeling that this is, you know. And then yesterday when he mentioned that, I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because it's too big of a footprint. They no longer need it, right?
Right. People do their banking online for the most part. Right?
And the reality is that the banks decided long ago to teach the consumer to use the tech. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the number of people that make deposits on the ATM, the number of people that never go into the bank, right? Maybe they use a drive through, but unless it's a community bank that really builds on relationships, you don't get that feeling when you go to any major, you know, federal bank. I understand where this is coming from. And I also realize the drugstores, I mean, there are so many drugstores, but I really enjoy that story where he mentioned about this former drugstore that basically was turned into a BP convenience store just for EV. They used the parking to build the EV charging stations, and then they used the actual drugstore as a basically like a convenience store that you find in any major gas station.
Well, and they found that those types of retail uses that do really well in a conversion like that include like vets, veterinary clinics,
That's right.
and medical clinics, because you can, or medical office, because you can run in while you're charging, drop off your pet, or drive through and put your pet. He was making a joke where Charlie would have to go through the former bank chute or something, but that you could literally pass off your pet without having to go into to the office itself. And I just want to do a shout out to our friend Beth, because she's been preaching about bank drive-throughs being for restaurant before COVID. And she's still high on it. She's still very bullish on it. But there are a lot of issues in doing any of these adaptive reuse projects, right? I mean, converting something like this to a restaurant would not only be a zoning change, you need to deal with grease traps and installations and all that. And sometimes the impact fees related to that kind of a conversion is cost prohibitive. So that's where working with your local city officials to say, hey, this is what you're getting now, this underutilized space, let's work together and change some of the requirements to make it a lot more feasible. Because at the end of the day, their tax base is going to go up.
And if the bank leaves your space, make sure they take the vault with them, because it's very expensive to remove the vault.
Although I have been to some really cool venues, including work, one of those like WeWork style places up in Tampa.
Where they kept the vault.
They kept the vault. And there's one here in Miami that is an event space where they kept the vault. Yeah. That was really cool. Yeah. So,
And I'll tell you, it's cheaper to do that than to remove the vault and then rebuild. So, you know, for sure. Yeah, so I thought that was really good. Definitely in industrial, he spoke about having vacancy fall in 2025. So again, very bullish on industrial, multifamily, and data centers, which that was another interesting question the day after when Rod Miller was speaking. They asked him about power, the grid, the power grid for the data centers, because there seems to be a lot of demand for it. And it was really interesting how he says that they're working with FPL to figure out how to create that, which, you know, I thought was really interesting. I didn't know this thing about them, about the creation of a second canal in the Suez. I thought that was really interesting. I love these international connections to the marketplace.
Especially to Miami, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, because that was after he spoke about all the ports that are in the East Coast. And I remember when we were in to the C5 conference and I went to that luncheon about industrial, how he mentioned that, you know, basically 66% of all of the goods have to make it to the east of the Mississippi River, right? That's where the people are. Mm-hmm. But everything comes into California. So that is an incredible expense. Well, if you have a second Suez Canal, they're investing $2 billion to make that happen. And now you have a lot of the transportation going from there, then they can make it to the East Coast. They don't have to go through the Panama Canal. They don't have to go through those things. I mean, I thought that was really interesting.
Right, because the biggest expense isn't the shipping. It's the trucking and the on-road logistics. Yeah. So shipping something from the West Coast to the East Coast is probably way more expensive. Well, it is more expensive than just taking the longer trip.
No, for sure. So this was his conclusion. He was looking at what are some near-term risk. Of course, you know, we're about to go through a transition of the government. There's uncertainty about the Trump tariffs. He got asked the question about the tariffs, and he felt that, well, last time there were tariffs, the countries figured out a way to bypass the tariffs by opening places either here or in other countries that don't get taxed. So he just felt that companies are going to figure that out. This port strike has been averted. So again, that wasn't a big concern. Obviously, we got to take into account what interest rates are going to do this year and where the yield curve is going to be. Inflation, that, you know, he felt it's not 100% tamed. Property insurance has carryover risk, but he felt very bullish on Florida, bullish on those three, the industrial, multifamily, data centers, which is really part of industrial. But in Florida, he felt bullish on office, on retail.
Yeah, he's pretty much
Exactly.
So, and then he did put in a quote about an industrial cap rate that we can get into, because Eddie Vasquez, who followed him, and he's an industrial broker with Comreal in Miami, gave a really good overview of our local market. And again, Miami is pretty much everything from Palm Beach County down to the Monroe County line, which, for those of you who aren't here, Monroe is where the Florida Keys start. So what I found super interesting from Edison's presentation is what you and I have been seeing, which there's a huge demand and a lot of opportunity for small bay warehouses under 10,000 square feet.
Yeah.
They're in very, very high demand for your everyday services and uses. But what's been built just because of land costs and changes in logistics are 100,000 square feet and above. He thinks there's going to be some price correction there temporarily while some of the spaces are absorbed. But I loved what he said about the flowers, because I remember flowers always being huge. And my husband comes from a flower producing country, Ecuador. And he said that 90% of the flowers that come into the U.S. come through Miami International Airport. Yep. And that is why we have such a huge demand for cooler and freezer space here, because of the produce that comes in from North America, Central and South America through the port of Miami and the airport. And he was like, cooler space. space is 32 degrees Fahrenheit and above, and that's pretty much used for flowers and produce, and that this price per square foot. And these prices, I mean, did you ever think you would see $22 to $23 a square foot and triple net? We're used to modified gross or industrial gross leases, and now the leases for industrial space is going the way everything is, just to pass the cost on to the tenant. And then freezer space, which is 32 degrees Fahrenheit and below, and is used for like meats and ice creams and more of the frozen produce and vegetables, are between $25 and $27 a square foot triple net. So again, huge demand. I've had several customers looking for freezer space, and it's tough. It's hard to find in the square footage that they need. It's either usually way, way too big, or it needs to be updated because it's second generation space, and a lot of what makes the freezer warehouse cold, such as the insulation or the chillers and freezers themselves, are so outdated that they need to be updated. And the other thing that's interesting about that is, from a landlord standpoint, even though there's good demand for freezer space, because it's not as wide of an audience, a lot of the places, such as one that our friend Jerry was leasing and I showed, they were going to make the tenant who was vacating the space and still had a couple years left, they were going to make them take out all of the freezer stuff and put it back to original space. So I found that interesting. And I know we have our friend Gus is building, is it freezer or cooler space that he's building?
Yeah, I think
warehouse. I think it's cooler, not freezer. So again, another opportunity if
no doubt
you're in the Miami area.
Yeah. No, I think I think it was really interesting as far as where the opportunities go. Felt that there was going to be a normalization of the rates for 2025. He did feel that tenants have an opportunity to lock in rates now. And obviously, prices are not coming down on industrial based on demand and based on lack of inventory, which is a part of it. But what I found really interesting is this, again, where are the opportunities? It's in the iOS improved sites for outdoor storage, the small bay development, which there's not a lot of. And interestingly enough, I know Gus was developing something in Alapata on a 5,000 square foot lot. And I think somebody came in and wanted to buy it before he even finished building it, because there's a lack. I think his footprint was going to be the total that they were going to build. It might have been a 10,000 square foot site where he was building about 5,000 square feet of industrial. And I think that those things are getting gobbled up, you know, like crazy. That was really, really interesting dynamics there on the market challenges and opportunities that are out there. So yeah, very good. The conference went a little long, so you know we didn't get a chance to see the retail and the office components. But again, our belief is that they're very much in keeping, and based on our conversations with those that presented, they're very much in keeping with what Casey Conway was saying, that there was a lot of optimism as to what those two, you know, asset classes, how they have been performing, and how they are expected to perform in 2025 and beyond.
Agreed.
All right.
Do you have a fun fact?
Your fun fact is my fun fact.
All righty. And so this is from Edison's presentation, because I thought it was fascinating. And it was the slide that he did on Miami industrial real estate being a major market now for institutional investors, whereas in the past we hadn't been. And he says the reason it's a must-have now for those institutional investors, very similar to LA in the Inland Empire, is because in Miami, our vacancy rate is 5.4%. Our asking rent is $20.40 a square foot. Wow. And our sales price is $258 a square foot. If you compare that to LA at 6.1 vacancy rate, or New York, New Jersey at 6.8 vacancy rate, with rents under $20 a square foot and sales prices at $262 for New Jersey versus ours at $258, and LA's at $303 versus ours per $258. Yeah. The math and the numbers are just way, way better in Miami, especially when you project future demand. So thank you to Edison for providing me with my fun fact of the day. And we'll have links to a lot of what we discussed in the show notes. So thank you for joining us, everybody.
Thank you guys for pulling up a chair once again and supporting this humble podcast. And we look forward to bringing you another episode next week. God bless you all. Bye-bye.
Bye.